This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Does media coverage of the Trump administration mark a turning point for American journalism?
What began as this kind of speak your mind thing has now gotten into speaking way more than anybody really needs to hear and maybe wants to hear.
Judy Valente talks with Illinois Wesleyan University journalism professor James Plath on ethical struggles for journalists, plus an acoustic visit with George Thorogood, who will have his destroyers with him in Bloomington this weekend, a visit to a national softball tournament going on in Normal, and GLT's culture maven weighs in on the movie Dunkirk. That and a GLT News update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. The New York Times and other mainstream media carried fired White House Communications Director Anthony Scaramucci's expletive-laced tirade against his White House colleagues verbatim. In other years, that language would have been too vulgar to print or broadcast. Should journalists report everything the president or other public officials say, even if it's rude, crude, or untrue? Illinois Wesleyan University journalism professor James Plath is critical of both the media and news consumers. He tells GLT's Judy Valente the way reporters covered the Scaramucci incident reflects American journalism at a turning point.
I do think that in this case, the New York Times probably made a mistake in publishing that particular four-letter word. We've seen language creep into newspapers over the years, but the F-bomb, I mean, you can't even see more than one of those in a movie, in a PG-13 movie, and now suddenly you're getting it in a newspaper. And this is a mainstream newspaper.
It wasn't just the F word. It was also a very vulgar expression for the male anatomy as well.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I was shocked to see it, to tell you the truth. But what's driving this is, I think, the fact that now mainstream media have to compete with the kind of blaring headlines that we're seeing from non-traditional news sources that are online. And I think we've seen this kind of language from non-traditional news sources over the last year. This is no surprise for them. It is a surprise for the New York Times. We're seeing our profession being kind of pushed into a new phase of what I would call another phase of yellow journalism.
We should note that not all mainstream media organizations did print these words. NPR chose not to use audio on that, for instance. However, have we crossed a line now that we can't go back on?
I don't know that that's the case. I think you could always go back. You could always roll it back. But they have regularized it. I think the problem, though, and I'm trying to get at the root of this whole problem, and I think it's pretty complicated, but I do think that look at the case of LeVar Ball. Here's a guy who's an obsolete athlete, and he's only gotten media attention for saying outrageous things because he's the father of a NBA draft pick. And the media are just following him around the same way as they did with Trump and the same way that they've done with other people. My point is, I think the media has become too personality driven. And whether they're giving the public what the public wants and the public is driving this, or whether it's the media that's chasing after personalities, that's a hard one to call.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that case, because I want to broaden it beyond the expletives of Anthony Scaramucci, who is no longer with the administration, who lasted 10 days after that expletive-laced tirade, to talk about just what the media covers. They cover every single tweet that comes from the president, and one could argue that a good number of them are very nasty. Is the media right to have to cover this? Do they have a responsibility to ignore some of the stuff?
Well, if they cover it, then you're going to continue to fuel the public's fascination with this type of language. What began really as a public reaction to over-political correctness, that's one of the things that led to or contributed to Trump's rise, the refreshing way that he seemed to people to be able to just speak his mind and say whatever other people wanted to be able to say but couldn't. But what began as this kind of speak your mind thing has now gotten into speaking way more than anybody really needs to hear and maybe wants to hear. So what you're going to end up with is a break point where people are going to say, as with Scaramucci, enough. Now, is it the media's obligation to keep feeding the public until they gorge on this, or is it the media's responsibility to cut it off long before that saturation point? I'm inclined to think the latter.
We're talking with James Plath, who is the R. Forrest Caldwell Chair and Professor of English at Illinois Wesleyan. He also has taught journalism at Illinois Wesleyan for the past 30 years. I want to go back to something you said earlier about yellow journalism. To me, yellow journalism was when newspapers, I mean, it was largely in the late 19th century, mid-19th century to late 19th century. And
mostly around 1900.
Early 20th century. Was newspapers really exaggerating things and sometimes even printing false things? That doesn't seem to be the case. The case seems to be news media is being accused of fake news if people don't like what they write. That's something different.
I do think a similarity, though, is in the degree of sensationalism. And I think that whether it's this coverage of, you know, foul language, or whether it's covering LeVar Ball and his antics, criticizing female refs or whatever, or saying he could beat Michael Jordan or he's a better tight end than Gronk. I mean, none of these things deserve to be said, but they're said because the media now is pursuing a cult of personality. They're personality driven as opposed to news driven. And I do think that tendency towards sensationalism does feel to me like another phase of yellow journalism. Same with the exaggerated headlines. How often have you seen a clickbait headline?
Clickbait headline?
Well, let's say that a story where the headline is provocative and the headline gets you to click on the story because it sounds like it's really racy, it's really shocking news, and then you get to it and you realize it's taken out of context or it's not as severe as that anyway. And that type of headline writing was typical of the period of yellow journalism.
Well, what do you want organizations like the New York Times, the Washington Post, NPR, CNN to do? If all of this information is out there anyway on all of these other news media sites and so-called news media sites, can you have some empathy as to the position that they're in?
Oh, yeah, of course. I think they're between a rock and a hard place here, to use a cliche. But I still think the only way out for journalism these days is to rely on the Society for Professional Journalism ethics, to go back to those, to stick to them.
And they would be?
To first of all report the news accurately, to seek the truth and report it, to act independently, be accountable and transparent. I think those are all very important things, as is minimize harm.
You bring up a good point there, because the public somehow doesn't distinguish between those who are trained professional journalists and those who have some sort of a political background, political axe to grind, who portray themselves as journalists.
Right. That's where we start to get accusations of fake news, because you do have a heavily biased slant. And according to the Society of Professional Journalists Code of Ethics, you are supposed to declare when you are biased and when you are in some ways filtering a story through something that's other than the objective.
You're listening to Sound Ideas. I'm Judy Valente. I'm here with James Plath, who is a professor of journalism at Illinois Wesleyan University. We're talking about the ethical struggles facing the news media. How can the public distinguish between who is a legitimate journalist writing an article and someone who is really writing from some sort of agenda?
That's a good question. And these days, I think that the safest answer is to stick with the mainstream newspapers, is to stick with the Wall Street Journal and the Christian Science Monitor and the New York Times. And even though the Trump people might disagree with me, CNN is not that far off the mark. I'm sorry. NPR is always right there. And when in doubt, BBC.
Another country to get your news.
Yeah, especially about America these days. It's actually a refreshing thing to do. And I mean, one of the things I'll do if I see a story and it seems outrageous to me, and I look at the source, and the source is, let's say, okay, slightly leaning left, Huffington Post. I'll look at that and I won't trust it immediately, simply because I do know it leans a little bit left. What I'll do then is I'll just look around. I'll go online and see if I could see the same story somewhere else. And if I see it on NPR, now I look at it, and now it's coming out of the New York Times. Now I'm going to start to read all those stories and look for some sort of overlap.
One thing that you see increasingly is, for example, the Washington Post, the New York Times, covering something that comes out of the administration or comes out of Congress, and then they'll debunk it in the same article. Well, if it needs debunking, should it be covered anyway?
At all.
At all.
Again, this gets into the whole issue that I take issue with now. It used to be that if someone made a claim, it didn't matter if it was a public official. It could be a senator. It could be a congressman. If that person made a claim that was unsubstantiated, unless a newspaper could substantiate that claim, it wouldn't be published. It wouldn't make it into a newspaper. These days, though, all anybody has to do is just claim something. Hillary did this. Hillary did that. And it's published, right? And so that's my contention with where journalism right now really has to fix itself.
But it is incumbent on the journalist to check that and
check out whether
it's true.
Journalists don't do that anymore.
Is it a time thing?
Run with it. Here's the deal. They run with a claim, and now for balanced reporting, now here's what new journalists think that they're doing. Now they're going to get someone to counter it. You know, it's almost like watching a speech from the president, and then you get the minority report, and then you get a 20-minute speech from the president, and then 2 hours of commentary of people going back and forth telling you what you heard or what you didn't hear.
Are we getting to the point where whenever we see a public official, do we have to have a fact-checking chyron underneath, running underneath what they say, or if it's in print, that we have to have a column alongside where we debunk or not what
they're
saying?
You would think that would help, but it wouldn't, and it hasn't. I mean, right before the election, there was a graphic that a third party, independent party, put together about truthisms. And I think it was Bernie Sanders scored the highest in terms of truthfulness, and followed by Hillary. And among the Republicans, it was John Kasich.
The Republican
who
candidate.
Was the most truthful. And Trump ranked very low. But that didn't matter to the public. And again, it's because of this claim of false news. Trump was even challenging the fact checkers, the third party fact checkers. So that leaves the public in a situation where they don't know what to believe.
How long do you think it will take to rebuild some sort of confidence in the press among people who have bought into this narrative that the press is biased?
I think the trust will be rebuilt not by political reporting. I think the trust will be rebuilt by the press reminding the public that it doesn't just cover politics. It covers and protects consumers. You know, it covers corporations. It covers environment. It covers science. It covers education. It covers all aspects of our lives. And when there is a problem, whether it's local or whether it's national or whether it's state, the newspapers are the ones that are the watchdogs. And I think it will be reminding the public. It'll be through reminding the public that newspapers reclaim their place as a trusted source again. But I don't think it's going to happen if they just stay in this political arena. I think they're going to have to put a lot more resources into investigative reporting and in other areas.
James Blath is the past president of the Illinois College Press Association. He teaches journalism at Illinois Wesleyan University, and he's the R. Forrest Caldwell Chair and Professor of English at Illinois Wesleyan. Jim, thanks so much for coming in and talking about this.
My pleasure.
I'm Judy Valente.
Attitudes about the news media diverge sharply along political lines. According to a recent Pew Research Center, 89% of Democrats say the media plays a critical watchdog role in society. Only 42% of Republicans say the same. Before the 2016 presidential election, roughly the same percentage of Republicans and Democrats agreed on the importance of the media role.
Support for GLT Sound Ideas comes from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd, helping individuals and families create solid plans for the future through a combination of investment options and life insurance. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come on today's program, softball in Normal. When George Thorogood plays the BCPA in Bloomington on Sunday night, he'll have his longtime band, The Destroyers, alongside, playing rock and classics from his extensive catalog. When fans give a listen to his new Rounder Records album, they'll hear something a bit softer. GLT's John Norton has more.
When most people think of the work of George Thorogood, it's normally with his band, The Destroyers. Rocked up versions of One Bourbon, One Scotch, and One Beer, Move It On Over, and of course his staple, Bad to the Bone, immediately come to mind. What doesn't usually come to mind is this.
One bourbon, one scotch, one beer.
This is from the album called Party of One. It's a solo acoustic album.
Bring another scotch and a bourbon and beer.
Thorogood said Party of One is something that's been on his mind for a long time.
How all week I've had a
baby. Well, it's a demand for it from over the years of the people that have been following this act, and that's how I started. And I had planned to do that to begin with and then move on later to form a rock and roll band, but it didn't really happen that way. I won't say I was struggling as a solo artist, but I was doing it, but it was difficult. And I knew I couldn't move any further until I got a record out. Then I had people around me, people such as Sonny Terry, Brian McGee, Robert Lockwood, and people who came to see me play as a soloist, who were very, very upfront and encouraging about, why don't you get an electric guitar? Especially Robert Lockwood. So, well, that's where it's at. And you know, I had a lot of rock energy in me. I was always breaking strings on the acoustic guitar. And, you know, I could handle a couple of songs, but my hands would get tired after a while. And so I got to move on to electric guitar. So I put the acoustic solo thing on hold for a while. And during my years at Rounder, that came up often. That subject came up often for that project. And I moved on to other record labels. And those labels were more interested in heavy rock than they were an acoustic statement. So once that ran its course, I bumped into some of the Rounder people. We stayed in touch over the years, and the president, Scott, said, you haven't forgotten about us, about doing a solo record someday, acoustic. I said, no, actually, I haven't. Kept that in mind all along. He said, well, let's give it a shot. And it was a lot harder to do than I anticipated. So, if someone comes up with an idea to do a solo acoustic record, I'm telling them to call Taj Mahal.
The sky is crying. Look at the tears roll down the street. The sky is crying. Look at the tears roll down the street.
I want to go back to Robert Jr. Lockwood. You brought his name up as someone who was very encouraging early on, and you say he encouraged you to plug in as opposed to be acoustic. What did he hear in you that he encouraged you to do that?
Because he said that's where it's at. That's where he actually told me some stories. It was strange that towards the end of his life, supposedly, I don't know if he saw it directly, but he said Robert Johnson was fooling around with an electric guitar. And some people said they'd seen him standing and looking in store windows at electric guitars, which were just starting to come out, supposedly, in the 30s. And I heard that he actually played with a trio briefly before he passed on. Robert Johnson, I mean, he was doing like kind of jazz kind of things. And I thought, well, that makes sense, because after those first two Robert Johnson records, there's nowhere left to take acoustic blues other than those two records. There's nowhere to go. And Lockwood was saying that's a natural progression. Everybody did that. John Lee Hooker did it first, then later Elmore James, then later Muddy Waters. And I saw Hound Dog Taylor, and I said, hey, man, that's it. That's, you know, forget it. That acoustic guitar started gathering dust after that.
Okay.
So,
all right.
It just felt natural to me, that's all.
George Thorogood is the voice you're hearing. This is GLT Sound Ideas. I'm John Norton. And Party of One is the new album, acoustic solo, George Thorogood. And you hinted earlier that it was a difficult album to actually even make. And you mentioned Scott, too. You were talking about Scott Billington, I'm guessing, of Rounder mm-hmm. Records. He's also said in the liner notes it was a difficult album. And he hinted that, and if I have this right, or he has this right, it was difficult because you had to reconnect with your youth. Is that an accurate statement?
Well, what I really had to do was reconnect, John, with my hands. My hands were not doing what they were once doing 40 years ago. I've been playing Get a Haircut for 100 years now, okay? I've been playing Who Do You Love since I can remember. So a lot of this stuff, it's like a language you've forgotten that you used to speak years ago, and you have to go back to it and brush up on it. Well, yeah, the songs made sense, and musically I could sing these songs because it's what I do, singing. But my hands were like, oh, wow, there was like a rebellion of like, oh man, I'm exhausted. I finally realized halfway through why I stopped doing it to begin with, John.
Okay.
Why I didn't pursue this is because it's a hard thing to do, you know. I mean, there's only one Lead Belly, isn't there?
Yeah.
I mean, come on. So, yeah, that was a struggle to find songs that George can actually do. And once people want to hear, and once we started branching out of straight blues and working on stuff by Johnny Cash and Bob Dylan and Hank Williams, who I love, Brian Jones, who I dig very much, you know, people like that. And they included a song that Rounder was hot about called Soft Spot, which is a sympathetic statement about the homeless in the world. Once we moved into that, things eased up a little bit. There's no way I can just sit there with that monster dobro and bang out 13 songs. That would be an impossibility for me.
Okay.
Yeah, it's not as hard. It's not as easy as you think.
From my childhood, where I am now, ain't gonna worry, I'll get by somehow. My mama had 'em, daddy too. I was born with the blues.
You mentioned that you had a hard time going back to playing like you used to, but at the same time, you've got a little bit more experience under your belt than you did way back in the day. What are you able to bring to the table for in a record like this that you maybe couldn't have done 40 years ago?
That's a good question.
Look at the hole I'm in.
I probably could have, because all along, since I was a kid, as far back as I can remember, I was playing the song No Expectations on my guitar, and that goes back to 68. I've always been into Johnny Cash. I've always been into Hank Williams. And so if you had selected this material, Boogie Chillin', of course, Bourbon Scotch and Beer and things like that, I would have been able to do it back then. It just would have been easier because I was more accustomed to playing by myself. And this is the record I should have made back then.
They went into a club, sat down at the bar that night. Some cat started a riot with Earl. That was his first mistake. John said, Earl, be cool, baby. I got the cat.
George Thorogood is who we're talking with. This is GLT Sound Ideas. Don't Mess with the Hookers is a song on here. It's a love note to John Lee and Earl Hooker. You covered his classic Boogie Chillin' as well. Are you particularly enamored with John Lee Hooker, or was it just a couple of songs you really wanted to put on there?
It's a little bit of both. He was the guy that really got me going on guitar. It's a very primitive style, very driving, very rhythmic, not too many, if any, chord changes. I found myself being able to adapt to Hooker's style of guitar very quickly when I first picked up the instrument, and actually shocked some people around me who were at a party once and heard me playing in the next room when I wasn't a guitarist, I was playing it. And they thought they were listening to a John Lee Hooker record and came into the room and said, well, what was that sound? I said, well, that was me. And there were other people who were accomplished musicians, guitar players as well. And they said, well, you better start working on guitar because you nailed it and it sounded just like John Lee. Later on, I found out a guy that I'm really into, Bo Diddley, who said to me, John Lee Hooker was the man who was responsible for Bo Diddley playing the guitar. He said, yeah, that was the guy he listened to. Bo, as you know, is very rhythmic. He can hang on one chord, make a whole song out of it. So I was, those two artists, but especially Hooker, I was saying, here's something I can get behind in a hurry. Don't Mess with the Hookers, I just thought it was a bad title. And you don't have to sing it, you talk it. It's a talking blues. I thought maybe there's a way I can adapt this thing without a band, because as you know, Hooker started originally without a band, and arguably some people say John Lee Hooker's best work is the things that he does by himself. So I said, well, this one I gotta give this one a shot.
I'll burn you down. Don't mess with the Hooker.
All right, George Thorogood, I want to ask you one more question. Party of One is the name of the brand new album. George is going to be at the BCPA Sunday night. You mentioned that you covered the Stones and Hank Williams. I want to ask you about that. You covered Pictures from Life's Other Side from Hank and No Expectations by the Stones. A great song, but often not considered when talking about some of those great old blues songs. Why did you include those songs on this album, which I'm expecting here, all those great old blues guys, right?
Well, Pictures from Life's Other Side was a song I've been playing for years anyway. So that was a snap. I did it at the Ryman Auditorium for an encore recently. And I got to play a Hank Williams song at the Ryman Auditorium. And I had the same dressing room as Hank Williams that night. Well, he wasn't there. Trust me, he wasn't there. But I had the same dressing room he used to use when he was there. So that was something that I wanted to do on a personal level. No expectations. There's perfectly good a reason for that. Brian Jones. And he played the slide on it. Brian Jones was the first person I ever saw play slide guitar. I saw him playing slide guitar on television. And I'd never seen that before. And he was one of the essential ingredients into forming that band into what they are today. And he did many numerous things that he played, whether he played piano or he played the xylophone or whether he played whatever he did. It was unique and it was brilliant. And I like the lyrics, too. You know, they're very bluesy, sad lyrics.
Take me to the station and put me on a train. I've got no expectations to pass through here again.
To this day, I don't think Mick Jagger gets enough credit for his lyrics. He's a brilliant lyric writer. They always talk about him wiggling around on stage and his great stage act and, you know, his latest girlfriend or something like that.
Right.
And I'm like, oh, wait a minute, man. You're not giving this guy a fair shake here. Listen to some of these lyrics. I mean, some of them are very funny. And he's a funny guy. That's the coolness of him. And he's also written some very sensitive things that are very, very beautiful, actually. Lady Jane is beautiful. Fool to Cry is beautiful. So it was a combination of Mick and Brian. But when everybody starts out, man, you want to perform like Mick Jagger and play slide guitar like Brian Jones, and you want your hair to look like Keith Richards. Cool. Having said that, it was a natural fit.
Party of One is the brand new album from George Thorogood. Thank you so much for your time, George. Congrats on the album, and nice to talk to you.
Is that a fact? Well,
it is. I enjoyed it.
Well, I don't get that too often. You know, they don't let me out very often, John.
No Expectations is from George Thorogood's new album, Party of One. He spoke with GLT's John Norton. George Thorogood and the Destroyers will be plugged in this Sunday night when they play the BCPA in downtown Bloomington. You can hear songs from his new album on GLT Blues Radio at WGLT.org.
And put me on a train. I've got no expectations. Through here again.
Support for GLT comes from Jack Baytall Real Estate Group at Keller Williams. Jack and his team are committed to helping Bloomington Normal continue to thrive by giving back to GLT and other local nonprofits. Current listings at jacksguarantee.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. More than 100 softball teams from 29 states have flocked to the Twin Cities this week for the United States 16 and under Girls Amateur National Fast Pitch Tournament. GLT correspondent Brian Bloodworth talks with Matt Hawkins of the Convention and Visitors Bureau and co-tournament director Carrie Fry of the Town of Normal. Fry says running a tournament of such magnitude at Champion Fields in Maxwell Park is not a new task.
Normal's had the privilege of hosting 12 of these. This is our 12th one since 1994.
And they always seem to get better and better.
Well, we're always excited to put these on, and sometimes the number of teams change from year to year, but they never get old or tiring, and they're still a lot of work, but a lot of fun to see what it does for our community.
Kind of take us through the process. I mean, you had to bid on this, you had to offer things, and how does that all work, and how far out did you have to bid?
Yeah, it is a bid process. We're competing against other cities within our territory, which is the Midwest. We go up against a very strong Sioux Falls group, Bloomington, Indiana, some areas in Kentucky. So it is a very competitive bid. We'll start putting our bid. We've already put our bid press bid proposal together for 2019. So we'll know at the end of October when we attend a conference in Greensboro, North Carolina, whether we'll have a tournament to bring to town in 2019.
What's the age for that tournament?
That one we're assigned for our Region 12. So it'll be a 12U tournament if we're fortunate enough to get it.
As far as the bid process goes, though, I mean, what do things people look at when they're awarding these bids, do you think?
There's a lot of things that go into it. I think number one and why we've had success is they look for experience. Who has been able to pull this off in the past? Who has the fields, the community, the resources to put this together? Our track record certainly speaks for itself. And then there's also a bid package. Financial part is always looked at as well. But the biggest thing, I think, for us is our experience. And then also, we can't deny we're in a perfect spot of the country. We're easily accessible by car, by many teams. And that cuts down on travel costs and also increases the number of teams that we have.
I know the economic impact is huge for the community. As far as the town of Normal goes?
Well, I mean, it's huge for us. We recognize what it does for our community, for the economic benefit. I'm sure Matt Hawkins, our sports marketing director for the Convention and Visitors Bureau, already has a figure in mind. I have not asked him for that, but in the past, it's always been over for this size tournament, number of teams, over $2 million. So it's huge for that. And for the town of Normal, it's just a way to kind of put ourselves on the map. I mean, everybody that plays softball within the United States knows Normal, Illinois, and a lot of it is because of softball and their experience with coming to town or having teams that have played in Normal and talk about our community when they come back home.
Year after year, does it get easier?
Brian, I wish it did. It really, everyone is different, and they're all challenging in their own way. They take a great amount of effort by those that put it on. Our committee spend many hours, days, and we started working on this back in January. And it's a great amount of work, but it's always rewarding when games start. Sometimes it can get a little tiring. You start putting in some long days. But once you actually see the game start, that's when it becomes rewarding to see what it does for these teams and our community to host.
What about the quality of play? I mean, 16U, you get some really good players, don't you?
Yeah, the talent level is amazing when you start thinking about teams from all over the country. We've got about 29 states represented here this week. And evidenced by the number of college coaches that are coming out to watch this talent. So we've got a list on our tournament website of college coaches that have indicated they're coming or have already been on site. And it's well over probably approaching 200 colleges that'll be here represented and watching these fine athletes compete.
And you've got all kinds of unique stories among the athletes, don't you? I mean, the parents, they spend a lot of money to come to take their girls to play. And
yeah, it's amazing. The crowds have been great out here. We know we have 116 teams, but the crowds have been amazing. The families and the friends that come out and support these girls, and this is not the only tournament they're playing in. So, I mean, this is week after week that they're playing somewhere, and it's really great to see the support that their teams, their fans have shown and family.
Well, Kerry, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Brian.
You're listening to Sound Ideas. I'm Brian Bloodworth, and we're talking with Matt Hawkins, the sports marketing manager for the Convention and Visitors Bureau.
Yeah, Town of Normal is really taking the lead on this. They've hosted national tournaments since going back to the 90s, even a couple international tournaments back when Champion Fields first opened, again back in the 90s. The CVB has been involved ever since the restructuring of our office back in the early 2000s. So we've been involved in every national tournament since about 2002 that I can recall. And obviously, the biggest reason we're involved is the economic impact these events generate for our community, the amount of tourism, the amount of hotel room nights that these events generate. We're talking about probably 6,000 to 7,000 hotel room nights generated from this one event for 7 or 8 nights, with 116 teams coming into town, eating at our restaurants, visiting our attractions, shopping at our retail stores. I've I've been out seeing a couple teams at restaurants. I've just at Dick's Sporting Goods, saw several players in there buying stuff. So with the economic impact that's generated, it's a no-brainer for us to get to be involved and assist any way we can to make these events as successful as possible.
What will the economic impact be roughly?
With the number of hotel room nights, we've estimated that it's a little bit over $2 million for just this 1 week. And it's certainly probably the biggest sporting event that Bloomington Normal hosts throughout the calendar year. There's some other large ones with the State Farm Holiday Classic, certain IHSA state finals. But this one, just with the sheer number of teams and the length of the event being 7 or 8 days long, has that large impact with again, 6,000 to 7,000 room nights.
And you're talking 116 teams, and they're from all over, aren't they?
They are. Just off the top of my head, I know there's some teams from Florida, Texas, Virginia, et cetera. So, yeah, they're coming from all over. There's several from Illinois as well. But that's one of the great things. It's funny, over the years, you see teams coming over from California, and you see team pictures being taken in cornfields because they've never seen cornfields before. So something that's mundane to us is kind of exciting for these teams that are maybe haven't been to the Midwest before. So it's pretty cool to see the teams come in from all over the place and get a little bit of taste of Bloomington Normal and Midwestern life.
And I know a lot of the CVB's involvement is with volunteers. How many volunteers do you have working this tournament? And it seems like they run it like clockwork.
They do, yeah. The town has this running like a well-oiled machine. Number of volunteers, I would hazard a guess, it's several hundred volunteer slots over that week. Doing anything from scoreboard operations, scorekeepers, public address announcers, et cetera, et cetera. You got people working the gate, parking volunteers. So, yeah, there's a ton of people that come out and help. And really, these events couldn't be done without the help for the volunteers. So thank you to those folks who've come out and taken the time to help make this one of the best events in town.
Is it hard to get volunteers, or is it a thing where people have done other events for you, then they just kind of are naturals?
There's quite a few repeats that do several events for us throughout the year, whether it's, again, the Holiday Classic, IHSA Golf State Finals, the State Farm Youth Classic. Some folks just love to be involved, love to be around kids, love to be around events. So it just kind of depends. There's a lot of repeats, but I'm sure also a lot of folks that are just maybe getting started and want to see what it's all about.
You're listening to Sound Ideas. I'm Brian Bloodworth, and we're talking with Matt Hawkins, the Sports Marketing Manager for the Convention and Visitors Bureau. Matt, what is it about these softball tournaments migrating to Normal? It just kind of seems like we have them, like you said, every few years, and it's kind of the home for softball, isn't it?
Yeah, I think we're kind of known for softball. Jeff Fritzen said it at opening ceremonies, Normal loves softball, and softball loves Normal. I think really it comes down to a couple things. Our location, being centrally located in the country, helps us. The staff that we have here, as I mentioned before, the town of Normal does a phenomenal job. These things run like clockwork. There's really no issues that I can ever think of that have happened that cause major problems. And then also the facility itself. You're not going to find a facility much like this anywhere in our area, much less throughout the country. There's a few, but we're pretty lucky to have a facility like Champion Fields that draw people in, and USA Softball realizes and recognizes the great job that the town does, the facilities we have. And the town of Normal has built a reputation over the years in hosting great events. So those kind of things just help us. And the incentives that we provide USA Softball, all those things combined, allow us to bring those events in every couple of years.
So you've been doing this all week, and you're winding down now with the championship play Saturday and Sunday. What's the format for Saturday, Sunday?
It's all bracket play. Teams will start being eliminated, and we'll get down to just a handful of teams over the weekend and decide who takes home that big trophy.
That's Matt Hawkins of the Convention and Visitors Bureau speaking with GLT's Brian Bloodworth. Bloodworth also chatted with co-tournament director Kerry Fry of the town of Normal. The championship game concludes this week-long tournament Sunday afternoon at Champion Fields. Bracket information is on the town of Normal website, normal.org/USA-Nationals. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Director Christopher Nolan's new war epic, Dunkirk, is a harrowing film of survival, resistance, and spirit in World War II. GLT's Laura Kennedy has more with the culture maven about the movie and what its place may be in film history.
In 1940, the advancing German troops trapped Allied soldiers in France on the beaches of Dunkirk, forcing a grueling evacuation. Christopher Nolan's new film is being called an intimate epic, and so far has been a hit with audiences, holding on to the number one box office position since its release 2 weeks ago. Sherry Zeck, interim dean of Milner Library at Illinois State University and GLT's culture maven, saw the film in IMAX and warns viewers to strap themselves in because this film is intense.
It's brutal. It's a strong film. The sound and the bigness of the picture was just increased the visceral response that I had to it. And it was a bit much. I was a bit shaken after the film.
Clearly a very exciting movie to see. Mm-hmm. How were the performances?
That is a really good question that I have been wrestling with, because there is not much dialogue in the film. And the film has several narratives that it cuts back and forth between these narratives, and eventually they kind of weave together, or at least overlap. But in terms of the traditional sorts of things we might look at to talk about the acting, there's not a lot of dialogue. There's one of the key characters is a pilot, and 98% of the time, all we see is his eyes.
He's on me. I'm on him.
So, is he a great actor with his eyes, or are we just projecting onto him what we're thinking about? How does that work? So, I think it's a film that really begs the question of what are actors giving in a performance, what are we projecting onto them, and where's that divide or connection? Now, there are also, I have to say, great actors in this movie, Kenneth Branagh, but his role is relatively minor, and my favorite actor, Mark Rylance, is in the film.
He's one of the greatest actors in the world.
He is. And most of people think of him as a British actor, but I like to remind folks he's from Wisconsin. I just think he's magnificent. And he's quite good in this. But again, in an hour and 45 or 50 minutes of film, he's got maybe 20 or 25 minutes of screen time. And a lot of it is just looking worried. Now, he looks worried really well. It's not a film that one necessarily goes to see because of the actors. This film is brutal, but it also has within it that through line that we see in classic Westerns, which is the conquering human spirit, the many faces of heroism, those kinds of things, that there is this uplifting line through the film.
You say there's uplifting elements in the film. Mm-hmm. Is this something that harkens back to more classic war films that we might have seen during, let's say, the 30s, 40s, 50s?
Absolutely. Yeah, I think it, in that regard, it's very much in line with those films where heroism is on display. Now, unlike those films, the randomness of death is also very apparent. And the physical difficulty of the conditions is keener and clearer in this film than in something like, say, The Sands of Iwo Jima, which, you know, you watch The Sands of Iwo Jima and you don't have a sense of the bugs and the drudge, and, you know, they kind of have dirty faces sometimes, but there is a look to the classical Hollywood film that kind of prettifies and nicifies even that difficulty and that brutality and those difficult circumstances. But nevertheless, there are acts of kindness, acts of bravery, silent solidarity between men. I mean, those kinds of things that we see in the traditional war film of the, let's say, the 40s. What I think is interesting about Dunkirk as a war film is the way that it does harken back to those 1940s films, yet with a realization of some of the key films that have come since. And in that line, I would say Platoon, The Deer Hunter, and Saving Private Ryan. One of the things that Platoon brought to the genre is the physical difficulty and weight and problems of being in the muck and the mud and the heat and the bugs in Vietnam. So you have some of that in some of the sequences. That physical discomfort is really highlighted and very clear. And then you have hints of the post-war trauma, of which The Deer Hunter is a classic example.
Are war movies, how we express them out of the American arts culture, are they history or are they modern propaganda? I mean, we could have a movie that was made, you know, a few years ago about World War II, but what does it really have to do with World War II? Doesn't it have more to do with today and how we feel about war today?
Absolutely, and I would say they're entirely propaganda. History has really very little to do with it. I mean, Dunkirk may be attracting some people to it because of its historical significance, and it may send some people away from it to look up the history, but it is very much about military failure. It is very much about so-called civilian involvement in war. And that is true of most war films. Certainly Oliver Stone wanted to say something about Vietnam, but he had things he wanted to say about Vietnam.
Well, he had his own personal experiences. This is him with his own personal experiences, hoping that it's going to resonate out with the public out there in the dark.
Exactly. And when he made Born on the 4th of July, which was about a particular person, he was really saying something about the 1980s and our responses to Vietnam, not telling us a thing especially about Vietnam and vets. So yes, films always speak to their moment, but I think when it comes to war films, that might be especially true because war is one of those things where patriotism and national identity are called forth in very clear ways. There's our side and there's the other side. And we, certainly in America, we tend not to brook any disagreement with that. Thus, Vietnam was such an incredibly difficult historical event for America that we've never quite gotten over. Voices against the war were taken as voices against America. Not all wars really do have a singular right and a singular wrong, even from an American point of view, but war films tend to treat them that way, which is why Oliver Stone's films were seen as such a break.
There are subgenres, of course, of war films. The coming home subgenre has always proven popular, going back to World War I. There was the big parade, although most of that was in the war. We had to deal with the after effects of the war, mm-hmm. of these young men coming back. And then, of course, we have Coming Home and the best years of their lives.
Yeah.
My goodness, that's an amazing, probably one of the best Coming Home war movies ever.
It's all right, Fred. Go back to sleep. Go back to sleep. Back to sleep, Fred.
It's really the one that people point to as a great example of the difficulties of people reintegrating into society. And yet, you look at it now, basically after you've seen the movies of the 1980s or the 70s and 80s, Apocalypse Now, Deer Hunter, Platoon, Born on the 4th of July, Coming Home, all those films. After we look at it through those eyes, and Best Years of Our Lives is really pretty benign. More or less, everybody gets reintegrated. One of my favorite films in that genre, because, of course, it stars the most handsome man in the history of cinema,
Gregory Peck,
is The Man in the Gray Flannel Suit.
Yes.
And it has, part of the film takes place during the war, but it is mostly about how this middle-class guy reintegrates into a middle-class New York business life and suburban home life. I think that film is honest in some ways, if you want to look at it that way. But as difficult as some of the things are for Gregory Peck, things end up working out okay. So I think we have a tendency in these post-war films, as much as there is something like in the 70s and 80s, those films that really focus on trauma that doesn't go away and how lives are destroyed having been in the war.
We hear so much in the news these days about post-traumatic stress disorder and the soldiers who are coming back from Afghanistan and soldiers who have served in Iran and so forth. Do you think that we're going to be seeing more of these coming home type pictures in the future as we start to artistically investigate post-traumatic stress disorder in film? Are we going to be seeing more and more and more of these coming out?
It is certainly something that is on people's minds. And as veterans of these wars themselves find opportunities to take up the camera, there will certainly be a push for that. However, we are in a different ideological environment, and whether they will get funding for these films is a whole other thing. Or will we see them as, will they only come up out as small independent films? I think we're likely to see them on HBO and Showtime and some subscription channels as miniseries.
Which might actually reach more people.
It might actually reach more people, and that doesn't necessarily mean subdued production values or anything that it might have meant 50 years ago. I expect to see more of those narratives, but what turn they take will be very much determined by where the money comes from to get them made and what our current ideological environment is. So what form those films will take, what attitude they will take, who knows? A film that I like very much, it's not a war film necessarily, but it's a film about the military, is a film called Soldier's Girl, which starred Troy Garrity. And he plays a kind of regular army guy who falls in love with a woman who is transgender. Now, given that just this week, our president has tweeted that transgender people aren't welcome in the military, where that actually stands is policy. Who knows what a tweet means in terms of policy? But can you imagine right now somebody getting $150 million to make a movie about transgender people in the Army? No. I mean, backers of films are going to be running from that kind of material. 10 years from now, when the dust settles on this issue, that's when you're likely to see the topic taken up. So present ideological circumstances, I'm guessing, will have some controls on what kind of films we see coming out of Iraq and Afghanistan and our experiences in the Middle East.
That's Sherry Zeck, Interim Dean of Milner Library at Illinois State University and GLT's Culture Maven. I'm Laura Kennedy.
You're listening to the music of Dunkirk. Hans Zimmer is the composer. Thanks to John Norton, Laura Kennedy, and Judy Valenti and Brian Bloodworth for today's show on Bloomington Normal's public media, WGLT Normal, a service of Illinois State University. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Let us know what you think of the show by emailing news@wglt.org.